Good morning, Chair.
Morning, Chairperson.
Allow me to welcome you all to this meeting this morning. This is a meeting of the Portfolio Committee on Health of the National Parliament, where we will be continuing with our NHI public hearings. We are having two presentations. There's a combined presentation between Section 27 and the Treatment Action Campaign, followed by a presentation by the Women's Legal Center and Sexual Reproductive Justice Coalition. We will, after that, consider and adopt the previous minutes. And just a reminder before I open fully, we hope that Honorable Imam Sheikh is having a good recovery. We've noticed him on the platform of Parliament, and so we wish him further speedy recovery. And please do not forget that this evening at 18:30, we are having a briefing by the Minister on the Omicron variant and the department, and you will receive or would have received a different link for that particular meeting. That's at 18:30. With that said, Ms. Maja Lamba, can you just take us to attendance and apologies, please?
Good morning and thank you, Chair. Present is Dr. Jacobs, Mr. Munyai, Ms. Gela, Mr. Sokacha, Mr. Siwela, Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ishmael, Dr. Tembe Kwaye, and Mr. Van Staden. I've received apologies from Ms. Chirwa, Ms. Sugars, and Mr. Imam Sheikh. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Majalamba. Before we go to the agenda, honorable members, I must remind you that this virtual meeting is deemed to be in the precinct of Parliament and therefore constitutes a meeting of a committee of the National Assembly for official purposes only. In addition to the rules of virtual sittings, the rules of the National Assembly, including the rules of debate, apply. Members enjoy the same powers and privileges that apply in a sitting of the National Assembly. Members should equally note that anything said in the virtual platform is deemed to have been said to the House and may be ruled upon. All members who have logged in shall be considered to be present and are requested to mute the microphones and only unmute when recognized to speak. This is because the microphones are very sensitive and will pick up noise which might disturb the attention of other members. When recognized to speak, please unmute your microphone and connect your video. Members may also make use of the icons on the bar at the bottom of their screens, which has an option that allows the member to put up his or her hand to raise points of order. The Secretariat will assist in alerting the chairperson to members requesting to speak. When using the virtual system, members are urged to refrain or desist from unnecessary points of order or interjection. With that said, before we go, welcome our people who will be representing their organizations and doing the presentations to us. Let us just formally go and have that agenda, please, flighted. Ms. Maja Lamba. So, honorable members, there is the agenda. I am looking for somebody to move to adopt this agenda. You may shout on this platform. I can't see your hand.
Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the agenda.
Thank you, Honorable Gela. Any seconder for the adoption of this agenda?
Seconded, Chair.
Is that Honorable Shamai Ahmed?
No, it is Honorable Sibuya Kwakhube.
Oh, sorry. I can't hear so well this morning. Honorable Kwakhube, thank you very much to both of you for moving for the adoption and seconding for this agenda. Let me then take this moment to welcome everyone else who has joined our meeting. This will be streamed on a couple of platforms, including YouTube and Twitter and some others. Just for you to be mindful, please switch on your microphones when you speak. And that will be both for the members and also for the presenters. I therefore also welcome the members of the media and all other guests who have joined us. And I also welcome now the presenters from Section 27 and the Treatment Action Campaign. And if you can please, whoever is leading, please speak after me and also introduce those who will be joining with you this morning. Thank you very much. And then go straight on to your presentation.
Good morning. Anele Yawa, I think, is going to start us off.
Thank you, Sasha. Good morning, Speaker and members of Parliament, including members of the media. My name is Anele Yawa, and I am the General Secretary of Treatment Action Campaign. And today, we are jointly going to present our submissions with Section 27. Just briefly, as you will remember, that in 2019, both TAC and Section 27, we made our written submission on NHI. TAC is a membership-based organization with more than 8,000 members, and we are working in more than 335 branches in 8 provinces of South Africa. TAC works on HIV and health as an activist organization working in the interests of the people of South Africa who mostly need the public health system to work. And also together, TAC, together with 4 other organizations of people living with HIV, which is NAPWA, Positive Women's Network, SANARELA, and Positive Action Campaign, we established a project which is called RECHIZE, which is a community-led public health monitoring where we are working in more than 400 clinics of South Africa in 27 districts. And in total, both TAC and RECHIZE are working in more than 650 clinics of South Africa and in more than 36 districts in 8 provinces of the country. And both TAC and RECHIZE are not working to serve the interest of their members, but we are working in the best interest of the public healthcare users of our country. Thank you. Over to you, Sasha.
So Section 27 and the TSC have worked together on this submission. Section 27 is a public interest law organization, and we seek to influence and develop and use the law to protect, promote, and enhance human rights. Our name is taken from Section 27 of the Constitution that provides that everyone has a right of access to healthcare services, food, water, and social security. And you may know of our organization from our past work. Our work in the last 2 years has included work on vaccine literacy. We've trained over 1,000 people about vaccines and the benefits of vaccination and of COVID-19 and in relation to COVID-19 generally. We've supported government's work on advocating for a TRIPS waiver. We've been engaged in litigation recently, intervening in a case about vaccination for children and intervening to ensure the continuation of the school feeding program during COVID. And at the moment, we're representing bereaved families at the last Epidemani inquest. Anela.
Thank you. So before Sasha gives the whole presentation, I will briefly give how did we engage with the public before we made our submission.
Excuse me, Anela. Can I just ask, are the only two of you who are joining us today. Do you have any other members you maybe want to introduce us?
No, it's only myself and Comrade Sasha who are representing both TAC and Section 27. There is no other person.
All right, you're very welcome. Thank you. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. So how did we engage before we made our submission? Both TAC and Section 27, we engaged with more than 1,280 people through the county dialogues that were held in seven provinces. In Western Cape, at Sivivana in Khayelitsha, there were 141 people, and in Pine Tree, Plettenberg Bay, there were 77 people. In Mpumalanga, in Driefontein Community Hall, there were 58 people. Kanyamazana Community Hall, there were 83 people. And in Limpopo, Tabernacle of Grace Church, there were 148 people. And at the Revolution Church, there were 123 people. KwaZulu Natal, at Napier Pastor Center, there were 31 people. And Mabuyane Community Hall in KZN, there were 120 people. And also in Gauteng, at Trinity Church, there were 79 people. At Boitumelo, at Mpumula, there were 90 people. In Free State, at Allenridge, there were 80 people. And at Thabo Mofutsanyane, there were 61 people. In Eastern Cape, at East London, at New Life, there were 69 people. And at location at Port St. Jones, there were 120 people. So in total, these are the number of the public healthcare users that we engaged with, and including the people that we engaged with through the retreat, the community accountability meetings that were held in six provinces. Thank you. Over to you, Sasha.
So in addition to the community dialogue that we undertook, in which we consulted with 1,280 people and incorporated their views into our written submission, we also conducted a survey on the Section 27 website, and we asked people three things. We asked about centralization of decision-making in the office of the minister or the person of the minister. We asked about transparency of the NHI fund and how important that is to people. And we asked about whether it's important for new structures to be tested before they're implemented or whether they should be implemented straight off. We had 232 respondents respond to this survey over a period of just 10 days in November 2019. And you can see the numbers or the percentages of responses. Overwhelmingly, there was a view amongst participants that that the power needs to be decentralized, the power in the National Health Insurance Fund and in decisions related to that fund needs to be decentralized and not sitting solely within the power of the minister. That it's very important, over 99% of respondents emphasize the importance of transparency in decisions related to NHI and the NHI fund. And there's also wide acceptance of the proposal that new structures need to be tested before they're implemented. And those views were incorporated into our written submission. So then, what are the principles that inform our submission? Section 27 and the TAC want to make it very clear that we support wholeheartedly any legitimate efforts towards ensuring quality, universal health coverage for everyone in South Africa. We're in agreement that the current two-tiered health system is inequitable and that the change to health funding is urgent. We're adamant that the right of everyone to access healthcare services must mean that everyone should be able to access quality health services on the basis of need rather than the basis of ability to pay. And we want to make clear also that disagreeing with elements of the NHI bill as it's currently structured doesn't take away from this. It doesn't take away from our agreement that the current system is inequitable and that it needs to change. Our goal here today in these oral submissions and also in our written submissions of 2019 is to assist this committee to ensure that the health systems reforms that are undertaken are implementable and are sustainable. So why are we worried about about some of the provisions in the current NHI bill? Well, the NHI bill envisages the establishment of a large and complex fund that'll be complicated to manage and tempting to loot from. It creates lots of contracting, contracts that require skilled HR capacity to manage. It creates new structures with overlapping functions and unclear relations to each other. It still remains unclear how the excess capacity in the private sector will be leveraged to the benefit of everyone in South Africa. And also unclear is how the underlying political and governance challenges that are currently the sand in the gears of our public service will be addressed. And so in our view, considerable work is needed to make the proposals of the NHI bill comprehensive, coherent, coordinated, and reasonably conceived. And doing so is a constitutional obligation on this committee and the department. And so what are our main issues? We've identified five themes in our written submissions, which we'll speak to today. These themes are governance under the NHI, corruption, putting principles into practice, so focusing on the rule of law, on participation, on transparency, and on universality, issues around financing the NHI, and the relation between the NHI and competition law. In our written submissions, we made clear and detailed proposals for changes to the text of the bill that will ensure that it meets our concerns. And we've provided those references to the textual changes in red in the slides that follow, but you've also been provided with our written submissions, so you'll be able to see those proposals there. So we start with the first concern, and that's governance under the NHI. And I know this is an issue that has been raised many times before. The introduction of NHI will transform the current intergovernmental fiscal relations, eventually vesting all finances in the NHI fund. And the size and function of the fund and the constitutional imperative of good governance necessitates the development of strong governance and improved accountability structures. So Chapter 4 of the bill sets out the governing structure of the fund in the form of a board that's accountable to the minister, as well as the powers and the functions of that board. As it's currently presented, there's a centralization of power with the minister and very little separation between the fund and the minister. And you can see that in the diagram here. The minister is empowered to appoint the ad hoc advisory committee, which interviews shortlisted candidates for the board. The minister appoints the candidates recommended by the advisory panel. The minister appoints the chairperson of the board. The minister removes board members, and the minister can dissolve the board. In addition to being so integrally linked to the governance structures of the fund, the minister is also very involved in the management of the fund. So the minister appoints and removes the CEO of the fund based on the recommendations of the board. And over and above this, after consultation with the board, not in consultation, but after consultation with the board, according to the Act, the minister also appoints members of the Benefits Advisory Committee, the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee, and the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. So the minister is really involved in both the appointments at managerial level, the appointments at board level, and also the advisory committees to the NHI Fund Board. We must stress that there is nothing in the Constitution or in the PFMA that requires this level of involvement by the minister in the governance and management functions of the board. And given that there's nothing that requires it, this needs to change, particularly because one of the significant contributors to the current failures in the public health system is the blurring of lines between the political and the administrative leadership. We've seen this over and over again. The centralization of power in the minister in relation to the fund and its governance and management constitutes a real threat to the independence of the fund and to the functioning of the fund. And in the light of this, we set out some recommendations for amendment to the wording of the bill to improve the resilience of the governance structure and protect it from undue influence. So we start with the independence of the bill. Section 12 of the bill doesn't specifically provide for the independence of the board. And in fact, it was previously provided for in previous iterations or previous versions of the bill, but it was removed from the 2019 version. The independence of the board is really critical for ensuring that it can objectively fulfill its functions openly, with integrity, and without fear or favor. It also enables the board to play an oversight function. and it'll instill public confidence in the fund. And therefore, we recommend the insertion of the word independent into Section 12. Now, of course, just writing the word independent isn't going to render a board independent. And independence must be built into the appointment and functioning of the board as well. And so that's what I'm going to move to now. The appointment of board members is provided for in Section 13 of the bill. And it's important that the appointment of board members gets done in a way, and of executives, gets done in a way that is transparent and that instills public confidence. Fortunately, there are examples of these kinds of processes that the committee and the department can draw on. So for one example, to inspire confidence in the new SARS commissioner, one of the recommendations made in the report of the Commission of Inquiry into Tax Administration and Governance at SARS was that members selected for the interviewing panel should be apolitical and not answerable to any constituency. They should be persons of high standing, and they should be able to inspire confidence across the taxpaying spectrum. The report also recommends that the criteria against which to evaluate attributes of the members of the interviewing recommends that there should be criteria against which to evaluate attributes of members of the interviewing panel. And so we therefore recommend that this example is followed, and that the ad hoc advisory committee must be composed of at least the following: representation from National Treasury, ideally an administrative head, the Director General of the National Department of Health, three members of this committee designated by this committee and representing different political parties, and persons with experience in governance and healthcare financing. Those are just some of the kind of representatives that need to be put on this ad hoc committee. Provision for the composition of the ad hoc committee should be included within Section 13.3. At the moment, there's no such provision. Secondly, the bill should set out the principles upon which appointment to the board is based. For this, we recommend, again, drawing from another example, and that's the Media and Development and Diversity Agency Act, which sets out that the appointment of board members must be based on principles of transparency and openness, public participation in the nomination process, and publication of shortlisted candidates. The published list of shortlisted candidates should also contain not only the names of the people who have been nominated, but the names of the people who have nominated them or the organizations that have nominated them. That's the practice that's followed in respect of the Road Accident Fund Act. So again, there are examples that can be drawn on. There must also be mechanisms to ensure that the public is able to make submissions on a recommended candidate, and that all those submissions must be considered in selecting candidates for shortlisting. This is a way to ensure participation in the process, but also the transparency of appointment to the board of this incredibly important structure. And then once the board members have been appointed, the recommendations of the selection panel should also be made public. And then we come on to the skills required and principles for appointment of board members. So the composition of a governing structure is a key factor in the performance of that entity, as we've seen time and time again with other structures. And in addition to its independence, it's imperative that the fund's board has the right balance of knowledge, skill, and experience. It's also important that the appointment criteria is clear, specifying honesty, integrity, and expertise as key considerations for appointment to the board. The composition of the board also needs to broadly reflect diversity across various attributes, including age, race, gender, and disability. None of this is currently provided for in the bill and should be. And we've proposed wording to include these additional criteria in Section 13.5. And then we move to removal of members from the board and dissolution of the NHI Fund Board. So Section 13.8 of the bill states that the minister may remove a board member who's disqualified in terms of any law, who's unable to perform their functions of office, or for any other reason. In terms of Section 13.9, the minister may dissolve the board on good cause. Now, removal for any other reason and dissolving a board on good cause is entirely at the discretion of the minister, one person, and can therefore be susceptible to all sorts of whims, political and otherwise. This significantly undermines the independence of the board, because the threat of removal without any oversight on any ground and without due inquiry would render board members unlikely to express views which may not align with that of the minister or other board members. We therefore recommend that a provision should be included to the effect that the removal of a board member in terms of Section 13H should be done only after due inquiry and on recommendation by the board. The bill is also silent on the procedure to be followed when replacing a member who's either resigned or has been removed from the board. And there's no explicit requirement for board members to formally declare a conflict of interest. These both need to be remedied. The bill should also be amended to insert a provision dealing with disqualification from appointment to the board. And we make a proposal for this in our written submission. Now coming to dissolution of a board. The dissolution of a board is a drastic measure. And the consequence is that an interim board needs to be appointed to act for a maximum period of 3 months. In our view, a drastic measure such as this should not be unilateral, but should be appropriately scrutinized and accompanied by parliamentary oversight. The dissolution of a board should require an inquiry and must be based on specified and objective grounds. Objective grounds for the dissolution of a board may include poor or non-performance of functions and abuse of power. And under such circumstances, the minister should be obligated to refer the matter to the National Assembly for consideration. And where the National Assembly considers that a board should be dissolved, the minister should have no discretion but to dissolve the board. The National Assembly must also play an oversight role in the appointment of an acting board. And we propose wording for these recommendations in our written submission. We then come to the functions and powers of the board. Now, in addition to its role as accounting authority of the fund, Section 15.3 of the bill states that the board must advise the minister on a variety of matters. And some of those matters are matters on which matters where the minister is the one who makes the final decision. So things like services to be funded, the pricing of services, transition from the current health system to so-called full implementation of the NHI fund. But other matters on which the board is supposed to advise the minister are purely operational matters, like the management and administration of the fund, terms and conditions of fund employees, and collective bargaining. Providing for this advisory role in respect of managerial or administrative functions really implies that the minister is empowered to make decisions in relation to issues on which the board advises them. But the operational matters on which the board advises the minister lie within the CEO's jurisdiction, not the jurisdiction of the minister. Only the CEO is empowered to make operational decisions about the fund. And so it's the CEO who would benefit from this advice of the board. And we suggest, therefore, that the operational and governance advisory functions of the board be separated so that the board advises the CEO on operational matters and advises the minister on governance matters. Again, we've made proposals for how that can be worded within our written submission. Then we come to the advisory committees of the fund. So there are three advisory committees that are established, and they're so-called committees of the fund. These committees are, however, appointed by the minister, not in consultation with the board. And each committee has a representative of the minister on that committee. And furthermore, the minister appoints the chairperson of each committee. So again, the minister is integrally involved in the appointment and functioning of these committees, so-called of the board of the NHI fund. There are a number of concerns here. In relation to the Benefits Advisory Committee and the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee, Section 25.3b provides that a member of the Benefits Advisory Committee will cease to be a member when they're no longer a member of the institution that nominated them. Now, that makes no sense given that the Benefits Advisory Committee does not purport to be a committee that's meant to represent certain organizations or structures. So it doesn't make sense that somebody should be removed when they're no longer a member of a nominating organization or company. We propose that this section, therefore, gets removed. And then there's very little detail about the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee. This is surprising given how very important this committee is to the functioning of the fund and of NHI in general. We propose that the process for appointment of members of this committee on their terms of office should be similar to what is laid out in respect of the Benefits Advisory Committee, and that the roles of both committees, the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee and the Benefits Advisory Committee should be laid out in more detail. Now, I've already referred to the concentration of powers in the Minister in relation to both of these committees, and we suggest that that be reconsidered. We propose that Section 25 and 26 be amended to provide for appointment of the advisory committee by the Minister in the consultation with the Board, and that the chairpersons of each committee be appointed by the committee themselves. Finally, there's no link between these two committees, the Benefits Advisory Committee and the Benefits Pricing Committee, bringing into question how rationing of healthcare services under NHI will work. Advice to the fund and the minister in relation to benefits and the price to be paid for these benefits have to be aligned. Otherwise, the system doesn't work together. We'll deal later with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. There are separate issues in relation to that. I'm going to move on now to what we've called under a theme of, or we dealt with under a theme of principles put into practice. And there are four issues that we want to deal with. Firstly, the role of legislation in health system reform. Secondly, the importance and role of participation. Thirdly, transparency. And fourthly, universality. So on the role of legislation. There's abundant global evidence that health systems function as complex adaptive systems and that a decision from the top does not just automatically render health systems change. Health systems are unlikely to be controlled, let alone reoriented into completely new and better performing systems by pulling strings at the top, even if those strings are necessary and they're well designed. And so while legislation early on in the process is needed for some components of NHI, such as the establishment of the NHI fund, for example, this is not the case for all aspects of NHI. Legislating on matters that are unclear, including references to possible options for the payment of healthcare services, and establishing structures that will require testing and possibly change, like the contracting units for primary care, is problematic for a number of reasons. So first, legislation is an exercise in precision, as this committee well knows. One of the formative principles of the rule of law is that law must be accessible, intelligible, clear, and predictable. An act isn't just a policy statement. It's binding, and it must be capable of being understood and followed. So for that reason, it doesn't make sense to include aspects that we're not yet clear on and that still need to be tested. Secondly, while promulgating the various sections of an act at different times allows for the phasing of change, such phasing doesn't allow for experimentation. And there's a real need for experimentation in health systems change. There's a lot of research on this around the world. So while dramatic change is needed, the process of securing that dramatic change has to be through evolution and iteration. That's how health system change works. So we propose, therefore, that the scope of the NHI bill be reduced to include only provisions that are certain and that can be implemented. That doesn't mean that things can't change. So the minister has extensive regulatory powers under Section 55 of the NHI bill. And that will allow for decisions about mechanisms and options and structures to be made in the process of implementation following experimentation. Not everything has to go into the bill. Where a decision has not yet been taken, like, for example, whether hospitals will be paid based on global budgets or diagnostic-related groups, or the types of tax to fund NHI, the options under consideration need not be provided for in the legislation. Again, this is not a policy document, but a binding act eventually. Doing so, including these options and these uncertainties, makes the law less rather than more certain and may open up the bill to legal challenge. Similarly, whereas in the case of CUPS, the contracting units for primary care, much more work needs to be done to determine whether a structure is needed, what it should do, how it will operate, and how it will relate to other structures. There's no need to establish such a structure in the bill. At the moment, for example, there's an overlap between the district health management offices and the CUPS, and that lack of clarity and providing for both structures in the bill without resolving that lack of clarity is in itself a problem. seems more appropriate to begin the process of active purchasing of healthcare services without legislating the local structures that may eventually play some kind of role in this processing, in this purchasing. In this way, options can be tested, processes can be refined, and models can be developed without the need for constant legislative amendments. So we propose that rather than introducing through legislation structures that need to be developed, capacitated, tested, and possibly changed, we legislate instead a process for thoughtful experimentation and piloting and provide specifically for capacitation and stewardship. This allows for considered and lasting health systems change without adding layers of complexity and administration, often at great cost, before knowing whether in fact they're needed and how and whether they will work. And we've included specific recommended wording in our written submissions. The next matter that I'm going to move to is that of participation. So participation of users in healthcare services and in users of healthcare services in decisions and processes that determine their access to healthcare services is recognized globally as a key pillar of universal health coverage. It's not just a matter of representativity. Instead, it's recognition that even technical decisions about what services are covered and how much they should be, how much people should be paid for providing those services are not value neutral. It's also a recognition of the importance of creating policy implementation plans and execution that are responsive to the needs of the people. This is a direct obligation in terms of Section 195 of the Constitution. The public administration needs to be responsive, and the health system needs to be responsive. And to ensure that, we need to make sure that there is participation in all the decisions in relation to the NHI fund and the healthcare services that are covered by that fund. At the moment, however, the NHI bill envisages very little involvement of civil society and healthcare service users in discussions of and decisions related to NHI. Provision is made for representatives of civil society and users in the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, but not in the other two committees of the NHI fund, the Benefits Committee and the Pricing Committee. So the Stakeholder Advisory Committee is the only place where civil society and health service users in the whole imagining of NHI, but it has no clear function. There's no function provided for this committee in the bill. It's not, despite being called an advisory committee, it's not in fact designated as an advisory committee of the fund. So really, what is its purpose? And what is the point of civil society and health service users being part of this structure where its role and function and utility is very unclear? Real and meaningful participation of civil society and health service users is not provided for, contrary to accepted practice around universal health coverage. Really, the Stakeholder Advisory Committee should be seen as key for facilitating public participation in the decision-making of the fund. If it were properly constituted and empowered, it would contribute invaluable evidence and expertise needed for the implementation of NHI. And then I referred briefly to the Rechise project that TAC and other PLHIV sector organizations are currently running. And it's that kind of insight that can really contribute to improvements in the healthcare sector, because it shows the real view from the ground, the real indication of what is required and how it should be incorporated into a system under NHI. The Stakeholder Advisory Committee would also be in a position to advise the other committee, to advise the Benefits Committee about issues relating to availability and suitability of health services, and it could advise the Benefits Pricing Committee on the affordability of healthcare services. There are examples of this. There's a similar participatory structure in Thailand that can be used as an example for the role of public participation, and particularly of healthcare users and civil society in structures related to national health insurance. And so we make a few suggestions. Firstly, we suggest that two members of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee that represent health service users and civil society be included in the other two committees. We also suggest that the Stakeholder Advisory Committee be designated as one of the advisory committees of the fund, and that the role of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee be defined as advising the CEO on best practices to safeguard the rights of users, improve access to healthcare services, and a complaints mechanism through that committee. We also suggest the involvement of civil society in other structures that are established by the NHI fund, including, or the NHI bill, including in district health councils. At the moment, while there is some provision for public participation in the health system, it's woefully insufficient and in most places doesn't in fact work. And we need to use national health insurance and the imperative of health systems reform to get public participation in the health sector in the interest of everyone. As I've said, meaningful participation in the health sector of users and civil society at all levels is at present sorely absent. And there are opportunities here to change that. Anela May in question speak to the currently operational Richiza project and how similar patient monitoring projects can contribute to participation in a responsive health system. Now on to transparency. So despite various provisions of the Public Finance Management Act and the Promotion of Access to Information Act, information in the public health system often remains hidden from the public. This includes all sorts of information, including about procurement, epidemiological information, and information on service delivery. Far from being used to promote access to information, PIA is often used as a barrier to prevent access to information. Both organizations have seen this a lot, and we see this in relation to our journalists as well. This has to change with NHI. To increase public trust in NHI, and to reduce the risk of corruption under NHI, it's imperative that all NHI processes and decisions are as transparent as possible. In our view, this requires specific provisions in law to guarantee such transparency. We all know what happens when decisions get made in the dark, and we cannot allow the lack of transparency and the corruption that almost inevitably results we've seen in our health system very recently to continue through NHI, particularly when we will now have a single source of funding for all health in the country. It'll just be too easy. So the NHI Act needs to unambiguously state that certain types of information should be made available to the public as a matter of routine without requiring request. Types of information that should be made public could include details of all transactions of the NHI fund, details of all decisions relating to the benefit package of the fund, minutes of meetings of the advisory committees and details of their decisions, details of all health technology assessments and justifications of the health technology assessment decisions. In relation to the Office of Health Products Procurement, detail of bids and evaluation and award letters and contracts and minutes and other relevant documents. We have a full list in the written submission. And then details of all decisions by the NHI fund or its agents to contract or not to contract certain facilities or groups of facilities. Now, we recognize that there may be legitimate debate about how general or how specific law should be regarding the issue of transparency. And we've taken this in mind in the proposals we make, so that rather than listing every key piece of information that should be available to the public, we've identified a series of key instances where small changes to the current wording of the bill can in meaningful ways increase the transparency of the NHI system that will be created by the bill. And full details of that are in our written submission. I move on now to the final principle that needs to be put into practice, and that's the principle of universality. Now, currently, everyone in South Africa is entitled to free primary healthcare services, free termination of pregnancy, and all pregnant and lactating women and children under the age of 6 are entitled to free healthcare services across the system. Everyone is entitled to HIV care. No one may be refused emergency medical treatment, whether that's in an ambulance or in a hospital. And that applies across the board. Refugees and asylum seekers and undocumented people from SADC states who need hospital services are entitled to be treated the same as South Africans, which means they get means tested to determine the level of state subsidization. That's the way the law is at the moment. The NHI bill, and I should pause to note that the way that the law is at the moment is in line with international best practice and is in line with our agreements with the rest of SADC. So the NHI bill in Section 4 changes this considerably. It provides that permanent residents and refugees will be treated in the same way as South Africans, but asylum seekers and undocumented migrants, regardless of where they're from, will only be entitled to emergency medical services and services for notifiable conditions of public health concern. The result of this is a significant and unlawful regression in access to healthcare services by asylum seekers and undocumented migrants from SADC states and their children. And this is something that we will challenge legally if it goes through. The regression in access to services for these groups is not just a human rights violation, and it is a human rights violation, but it's also of public health concern. Here we are on World AIDS Day, celebrating the huge successes that South Africa has enjoyed in relation to the treatment, the testing and treatment of HIV. But as under NHI, asylum seekers and undocumented migrants would not be able to access screening and treatment for HIV. The epidemic in South Africa affects everyone living in South Africa, regardless of their legal status. South Africa has pledged to leave no one behind in its work to achieve the 1990-90 targets. And excluding asylum seekers and undocumented people from HIV care would constitute a major and fatal setback in our pursuit of this goal. It would affect both South Africans and migrants alike. And it's also likely to increase transmission of HIV from mother to child, undoing the impressive advances that South Africa has made in this regard. Asylum seekers and undocumented migrants under NHI would also be excluded from sexual and reproductive health services, which are specifically provided to accord to everyone in terms of Section 27 of the Constitution, and are recognized around the world as a key component of universal health coverage. A lack of access to contraceptive services and safe abortion, for example, would put already vulnerable women and their families and their children at even greater risk. The exclusion of maternal healthcare services from a package of services available to asylum seekers and undocumented migrants under NHI would see South Africa reversing its gains in relation to maternal mortality. Similarly, the very narrow definition of emergency medical services, which bizarrely limits emergency medical services to the services provided in an ambulance, means that asylum seekers can be picked up in an ambulance and they can receive services in that ambulance, but they can't access emergency medical treatment at home. This directly violates their rights under Section 27(3) of the Constitution, and it puts ambulance drivers themselves in an invidious position where they may pick someone up, but they have nowhere to drop them. So they may treat people within ambulances, but then they can't take them to hospital to receive emergency medical treatment, a direct right under our Constitution, and something that is a clear moral obligation to us as South Africans. Section 4.1 of the bill provides in subsection 3 for the purchasing of services by the fund for so-called certain categories of individual foreigners determined by the Minister of Home Affairs after consultation with the Minister and the Minister of Finance by notice in the Gazette. This is incredibly vague. And in the light, it's particularly in the light of the fairly exhaustive listing of categories of people in Section 4 as a whole, where it lists who will be entitled to access services paid for by the fund. We have no idea who is likely to be included in this Section 4.1e categories of so-called individual foreigners. And no guidance is provided for this in the memorandum to the bill. So this is very far from meeting our concerns about exclusion of many people under a purported system of universal health coverage. So we suggest as follows. We suggest that the bill is amended to put asylum seekers, refugees, and undocumented people from SADC states and all children in the same position as South Africans as they are currently in law, and to provide for limited care, at least, for undocumented migrants from outside of SADC, including primary healthcare services, emergency medical treatment, services for notifiable conditions of public health concern, sexual and reproductive healthcare services, and services related to HIV. In doing so, we will not be regressing there will not be a regression in realization of the rights of people living in South Africa. which of course is our constitutional obligation. Now I move on to the next theme, and that's financing of NHI. Now it's imperative that investing in healthcare and protecting health resources is recognized as an investment in productivity and economic growth, as well as in equity and human rights, and that this recognition is acted upon. And I'm sure that this committee will agree. Key to the delivery of equity, quality, and universality in access to healthcare services under NHI will be the sustainable and affordable financing of NHI and the efficient, equitable, and effective expenditure of NHI funds. And while more investment in health is certainly needed, it isn't only a lack of resources, but their inequitable distribution, historical underinvestment in the public sector, particularly in rural areas, corruption, wastage, and mismanagement that is in the way of access to quality healthcare services for all. Clarity and transparency in relation to funding of NHI is desperately needed. And this committee and Parliament, I think, is in a very difficult position, trying to consider the NHI bill without clear indication of funding. It makes it very difficult to know whether you are passing a bill that's a mere aspiration or one that has been planned for and can be funded, albeit in stages. Austerity budgeting, the likes of which we're currently seeing, makes NHI impossible. The average change of health spending across the NTBPS will be insufficient to maintain, let alone to transform levels of staffing, equipment, and infrastructure, and therefore improve quality in the health system. The only foreseeable outcome of this budgeting is that many of the proposals in the NHI bill will simply not be implemented. And I trust that this committee is considering these issues while also considering the bill. It's important that we do what we can to stop the reduction in budgeting for health, because without doing so, we won't be able to maintain, let alone to improve our health system, which is sorely needed. We've seen from the recent NTBPS that Treasury doesn't envisage NHI being implemented, essentially, in the medium term. And the financing of health system reform is key to making health system reform happen. We need to focus on this. Then on to competition law and the NHI. So section 3.5 of the bill says that competition law doesn't apply to transactions under the Act, or the Competition Act doesn't apply to transactions under the NHI Act. In our view, it's an overreach to exclude all transactions, so-called transactions under the Act, from the competition law regime. And it may be detrimental to both the fund and to access to healthcare services. The purpose of the Competition Act is an important one. Its purpose is to promote and maintain competition to attain several goals, including efficiency in the economy of the country, competitive prices for consumers, promoting employment and social welfare, ensuring small and medium enterprises and historically disadvantaged people and businesses are able to participate in the economy. These are all important national goals. And we think that there is a strong role for competition law to play to maximize the benefits to the fund. Some of the unintended consequences of excluding competition law entirely are collusion by companies who are tendering for the fund. And the reason that this is an unintended consequence is that arrangements between companies who are tendering for the fund could be considered transactions under the Act. There's no definition of transactions under the Act. And so the Act or the bill at the moment is leaving wide open the possibility of collusion by companies who are trying to be paid by the fund, essentially. And this has happened in the past. In fact, it happens quite a lot. And the medical and pharmaceutical sectors are quite prone to this kind of collusion because they're often very concentrated. And so there's real scope for collusion here. And just having a broad exclusion of all transactions under the NHI Act from regulation under the Competition Act increases significantly the risk of collusion. There's also a risk of the fund abusing its dominance. And in some ways, this is almost the intention, in that the intention is that the fund becomes the sole purchaser of services. And it's based on that that a lot of the proposals under NHI are made. The problem with that is that the fund could, in abusing its dominance, it could do so to the detriment of SMEs and historically disadvantaged individuals and businesses, who then end up leaving the sector because they're unable to provide services at the prices required, leaving health service provision to one or two dominant players. And again, we're back to big players. And there's a real risk there, not just because that doesn't provide quality and alternatives and choice for the fund, but also because it's bad for healthcare services in general, for there to be fewer service providers. And so while it may be seen as an advantage for the fund to be able to unilaterally provide prices, there's also a real risk to the fund and health service provision. It's not necessary to exclude all transactions under the Act from the competition regime. There is provision for exclusions from the Competition Act. We've seen that during COVID, and there are other options available. There are possibilities to make it work within the current competition law and to retain the protection that competition law provides for everyone in the country. And we've made specific proposals in relation to this in our written submissions. Now, also related to competition law is the health market inquiry. Now, this committee will know well that there was an inquiry into the private health sector that was conducted over a number of years and a report published at the beginning of 2020. And it made a series of findings that showed just how desperately needed reform of the private sector really is. And it made important recommendations to government and to the competition authorities and to the regulators for reform of the private sector. It's what's important to recognize and seems to have been lost is that such reform could contribute to universal health coverage through standardization and quality monitoring. It's not one or the other. It's not implementation of the HMI recommendations or NHI. Instead, it's clear that the private sector needs to reform, and it cannot be left in a state of dysfunctional regulation awaiting the full implementation of NHI. So there are a number of recommendations of the Health Market Inquiry, and there are a few that I've picked out just to show how implementation of those recommendations can contribute to universal health coverage. The first is the recommendation that the medical schemes have standardized base packages of services. Now, this, as has been recognized by GEMS, could be a good way for the NHI fund to learn what a base package of care might look like and to test it out. That still hasn't been implemented, and is in some ways an easy win. The second is the development of a supply side regulator, which could then expand to include the public sector. So again, a way of standardizing across sectors. And the third is the importance of quality measurement in the private sector. And this can be across the health system, but this can be piloted in the private sector and could then form a basis for quality monitoring across the health system, which will make it easier for the NHI fund to decide what services to purchase. So with that mouthful, where to now? As I've said, our written submissions contain detailed proposals for amendments to the NHI bill that would render it constitutionally compliant and would enable it to meet the concerns that we've raised. The written submission is provided on our website and has also been emailed to all of the members of this committee. In addition to our proposals, in addition to our written submission, Section 27 has worked with Concentric Alliance, which is a partner organization, on a report about health systems reform. We've done so over the past year, because what we wanted to know is what do people in the sector, across public and private regulator, academia, journalists, unions, and everybody else, what do we really agree on when we're not on TV, when we're not making public statements? Are there in fact areas of agreement that can be built upon to ensure real health system reform? And where are the areas of real disagreement that need to be worked on? And this is recognizing again, as I said at the beginning, that health systems change doesn't just happen because you legislate it. Health systems are very complex beings and rely largely on the people and the structures within them. And so the input and the buy-in of those in the system and the reliance on the skills and expertise and experience of those within the system are really key in making health systems change actually happen. So we undertook this research. We interviewed 33 key stakeholders across the system, and we've developed a report that has been emailed to you and will be released on our website today. And what did we find? Well, unsurprisingly, there were some areas of real disagreement, and you all know those areas. But also, there were areas of surprising agreement which really excited us. Absolutely everyone across the whole of the health system that we interviewed said that the foundation of the health system is the right of everyone to access healthcare services. That is amazing. That's not the case in every country. And it's a testament to the power of the Constitution in the eyes of people within the health system. Everyone also agrees, importantly, that there is a need for health system reform. Also importantly, everyone who we interviewed agreed that there are governance, accountability, and management issues that need to be attended to urgently. And everyone agrees that there is a need for and the possibility of collaboration, both across public and private sector, and from regulators, civil society, unions, and others. There were other areas of agreement that we were excited about. Many respondents agreed on the need to test out, to try different mechanisms for harnessing private sector capacity and establishing systems for a rational referral process. Many people agreed on the need to monitor health outcomes and orient our health system to respond to those health outcomes. And many agreed, importantly, with the need to better regulate the private sector, including the pharmaceutical industry. So there are really many areas of agreement. So what are the recommendations that came out of that report? Well, there are two paths that we've recommended. And these are not paths that need to be taken one after the other, but can preferably be taken simultaneously. The first is that real action can be taken on areas of agreement. There are things that many people across the health system agree on that we can act on now. And in doing so, we can start seeing the kind of health system change that we need to and start building the trust that's required for more for further health systems reform. And then there are the areas, the sticky, wicked problems within our health system that require further consensus seeking, recognizing that there are many players within this system and that there is a need for collaboration in order to make those things work. So the first, the path one areas for action, there are a few different things that there seems to be broad agreement on that could be implemented now. And in many cases, wouldn't take huge budgetary allocations. The first is real piloting of contracting and referral mechanisms, either in a province or a series of districts that actually experiment with alternative options for delivery. This committee has heard the report of the previous piloting process, which made it clear that there was really no experimentation and very little true piloting. And there's an agreement that there's a need for proper piloting of different mechanisms to see what actually works and to measure what actually works. The second area for action is national health projects. Which require collaboration across government, civil society, and the private sector. And some options that were provided were ICT integration, procurement, infrastructure and logistics management, and others. The third was the establishment of health outcomes indicators for measurement across sectors. And pre- and postnatal care were identified as good options for this. The fourth is implementation of key HMI recommendations, and we've listed some of those. And the fifth is exploring the possibility of procurement reform with the various role players involved. So these are things that the majority of people who we interviewed across the health system agree there can be action on now. And this doesn't take away from national health insurance, far from it. In fact, it moves us towards universal health coverage, and it starts to develop the kind of trust and the assessment of what works and what doesn't that is needed for further health systems reform. The second path is on consensus building. And there are some issues that you won't be surprised about where there is very little agreement. And even people within sectors that you'd be surprised about disagreeing disagreeing with each other are disagreeing. The first is the role of medical schemes. There's real concern about the role of medical schemes as provided for in Section 33 of the bill. The second is the how to produce and retain sufficient and appropriately qualified human resources for health. And the third is about the roles of different departments of health in relation to each other and in relation to other structures. These are issues about which there remains significant disagreement and we think would benefit from a real consensus building process. As I said, both paths work towards the same result. They're meant to improve the health system for the benefit of the people that need it while reconciling the inputs of various stakeholders that are needed to make health systems reform work. These are not alternatives, but should be pursued simultaneously and can be pursued simultaneously if we in fact want to change the health system in a way that benefits everyone in South Africa. Anela, over to you for the conclusion.
Thank you, Sasha. So, Chairperson and members of the committee, as TAC and Section 27, in conclusion, we submit that this committee should require that the problems with the NHI bill are attended to. And two, we recommend that the government take action on areas where there is consensus to secure improvement and build trust. And three, we recommend that a real and good faith engagement in a consensus building process across the system to resolve some of the matters that could stall the health system reform indefinitely. Both as TAC and Section 27, we thank you for listening to us. Thank you, Chairperson. Over to you.
Thank you very much to both of you for the presentations. We had given you more time because you were doing two presentations in one. So, yes, I'm just answering maybe for some of the members who might have had a concern that I am giving you more time. Let me thank you, Sasha Stevenson and Anele Yawa, for your presentations. The members would like to raise some questions with you and maybe a few other points with you. So I'm going to have a look at the list of members who would want to raise those questions with you. Firstly, we have Honorable Gela, followed by Honorable Wilson, followed by Honorable Sukacha, Honorable Abad, and those are the four at the moment.
Sorry, Chairperson, I think I raised my hand on the system and I was the first one there. I didn't raise it on WhatsApp, please. And I need to be on the flight. Can I be given an opportunity to...
You can be first, Honorable Temakwayo. So then Honorable Temakwayo, Gayla, Wilson, Tukacha, and Haber. So yes, okay. You're welcome.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presenters of today. I've got only one question to ask, and it's based right at the beginning of their presentation. They said to us the respondents that they used to draw their findings on compiling the information as it is presented as today was drawn from 7 provinces. My question is, what about the other 2 provinces? Would their contributions or their response to their question have maybe made a different information that they could use to compile their content? So I would just would like to know about that, to say why were the 2 provinces left? And why were they not part of the respondents to their questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from TEC. Chairperson, my first question, you state upfront that you support universal health coverage, but much of your statements seem to go against your support for NHI. You say you aim to help Parliament to ensure that health system reforms are implementable and sustainable. Section 3 to ensure that I'm using the phone that is tipping me, Chen, to ensure that sustainability of the NHI through various measures. Is that not adequate? My second question, Chairperson. My second question, you maintain that the idea is to establish a complex fund that will be difficult to manage.
Is that on my side or on your side, Honourable Geller?
Can't hear Honourable Geller at all, Chair.
Who's on her side? Honourable Geller? If you're struggling, Honourable Geller, I'll put you later in the queue again after Honourable Wilson.
In equity.
Honourable Geller, can you hear me? I will shift you back in the queue. I'll take Honourable Wilson and then Honourable Hubbard, and we will try to get you again after that. And if not, you can pose your question to me.
Chairperson, I'm still on the platform.
Now you're back again.
I don't know whether you captured my questions so far.
No, we haven't. That is where I was saying that I was going to put you further back in the queue. But since you're so clear now, can you continue?
Yes, Chairperson.
Yes, please continue. Maybe just start with your last question from scratch again.
From my first question, Chairperson.
From your second question?
All right, Chairperson. My other question, Chairperson, that I want to ask, is just I noted somewhere, and now.
You can also start in the beginning, Honourable Geller, if you want to. You're welcome.
All right. Okay, Chair. That will be fantastic. Thank you, Chairperson. My first question that I want to ask from both presenters, the first one, you state upfront that you support universal health coverage, but much of your statements seem to go against your support for HI. You say you aim to help Parliament to ensure that health system reforms are implementable and sustainable. Section 3 is dedicated measures to ensure the sustainability of the NHI through various measures. Is that not adequate? My second question, you maintain that the idea is to establish a complex fund that will be difficult to manage. Does the current fragmented system now not ensure inequity in access to healthcare for all? The other question, Chairperson, that I want to ask, in Section 39A, of the bill does make a provision for the minister to consider a representation from the board before making the decision to either dissolve it or not. My question is, do the TAC and Section 27 not believe that this provision will cover the concern raised in this presentation? There's something that is disturbing me, Chair. I don't know whether it's from my side or your side.
Sorry, at my side, we're having a power failure here. I'm just going to try to connect some extra power. Honorable Gela, if I get cut off, please continue.
The other question, Chairperson, I get the sense that the TAC and Section 27 are advocating for the perpetual existence of undocumented immigrants within the South African borders. May I require why that is, and why is the presenter providing solution or proposal on how the undocumented migrants should be dealt with in a way that grants them a status of permanency which is not aligned with what the bill is trying to achieve for South African citizens. The last one, the Chairperson, what is the view of Section 27 and the TAC on the future role of the medical schemes under NHI? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Wilson. I might get cut off. I'll see what I can do. Continue, Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for a very in-depth and very thought-provoking presentation. I thought what you presented today was excellent, and I think that your submissions require a lot of thought indeed. My question, however, is this. Okay, so what is NHI? NHI is the right of access to all South Africans or to all people in the country, principally at no cost to quality health care. Now, principally, we already have NHI then, surely, because nobody in this country at the moment is unable to go to a hospital or a clinic and get services. Obviously, the question is quality health care that does not exist at the moment. But does that not mean that NHI is already in place and what we have to do is actually just refine the quality of health care? The question is, are you in agreement with this and what is the way forward? I think a lot of that has been covered in your presentation. I agree with you that governance is indeed an issue and that we cannot have a minister being responsible for everything, and I do like your proposals. Thank you very much. I want to talk about the funding of NHI. Now, currently, health is funding...
Honorable Wilson.
I'm here.
I can't hear Honorable Wilson proper. I don't know if it's my side or...
Honorable Gayla, the problem is on your side.
Okay.
Thank you. So I want to talk about one of my issues is the funding of the NHI, and you are quite correct. There is absolutely no idea or indication how this can be funded. But one of the biggest challenges South Africa is facing at the moment, particularly in terms of health resources, staffing and all of those kind of things, is a result of the astronomical medical claims and legal costs that the department faces at the moment. And these run into absolutely billions. And it is a huge concern because when we are paying out billions in claims, and there's billions still sitting on the table that still need to be dealt with, we end up with a result of very poor health services, very short staffing, lack of medical resources, lack of medical equipment. We've even seen a situation in Johannesburg where people, one of the hospitals has been unable to do operations because of a lack of clean linen. Now, this is very, very concerning. These are not going to go away anytime soon. Medical claims and legal bills cannot be budgeted for either. So I'm very curious to know how you think we are going to get around to quality health services when, number one, our health services are diminishing and diminishing fast as a result of this, and what we are going to be able to do to correct this in the future. I'm also very glad that you raised asylum seekers, undocumented migrants. The law is very clear. The international agreement is that people, whether they are documented or undocumented, are entitled to proper health care. And I am also very concerned about the fact that this goes against the international law, the international standards of health, and we support you on that. And basically, your comments on competition law, I think that's very, very important, and I thank you for the in-depth presentation on that, because there is no doubt that we are going to see collusion by companies, and people are already concerned that this is already happening with the vaccination program. So principally, two short questions and the rest are comments, but I thank you for a very, very thorough presentation and a very thought-provoking one. You obviously put extensive time into this, and it was well worth listening to. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Just a few questions from my side. Let me also join my colleagues in welcoming the presentation from the TEC. Just three questions, Chair. The first one, you have asked a good question of how additional capacity will be accessed. During the era of COVID-19, the public and the private sectors work together to save facilities, human resources, funding, and vaccinated the population. Is that not a model that can be used under the National Health Insurance? Would you not agree that we have come a long way in this country to improve collaboration between the public and the private sector? That is my first question. My second question is you are concerned about a single payer NHI fund. I understand that a single payer system has more incentive to direct healthcare spending towards public health measures than separate medical schemes. For example, under universal health coverage, a full range of essential health services, from health promotion to prevention, treatment, rehabilitation, and palliative care, is provided to all based on need. Is such a system not desirable? How do we think about it? And my last question, Honorable Chairperson, where the survey respondents engage in qualitative research with the aim of establishing reasons behind the responses provided in the survey. In other words, when they say there must be decentralization from Minister of Health, then who do they suggest should be held accountable for the implementation of the NHI policies? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. First one, you call for a separate process for reaching a consensus on NHI. The public elects parliamentarians through a democratic process. How is it possible to have another democratic process that does not undermine the will of the people? Second one, the presenter has raised concerns with members of the board having to resign once they are no longer members of the body that appointed him or her. Are you proposing that the appointment of the members of the advisory committees should not be supported by institutions in the first place? Thank you.
Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I really listened to the presenter, but I want to ask the following question. May I please get a sense of clarity regarding the views of the TAC and Section 27 on who should be appointed into Stakeholders Advisory Committee, especially given the presenter suggests that members of this committee will offer advice to the fund on issue relating to affordability, a term which, to my knowledge and my understanding, is not easily quantifiable. If they can please really address that issue, I'll be very excited if they do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members and the presenters. Just a bit of patience with me because now I'm working with one device only, which is my telephone, which I don't need power for. And I have my questions also written on the same device. So I'm going to have to be flicking between platforms here. So a bit of indulgence from all of you. Let me start. Before I do that, honorable members, anyone else would want to ask any questions or raise any concerns?
I'm covered, honorable chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anyone else again before I will ask some questions in the end? In the absence of those, I need to just flick around again. Let me raise a few points. Now, in terms of the governance issues which you have raised, presenters, you talk about the concerns that the establishment of the system lends itself to corruption. Now, we agree that corruption is unacceptable, and a corrupt person, we also know, always finds him or herself ways to steal. But your organization is part of the world, the health sector Anti-Corruption Forum. Would you please share with us what measures you have put in place to tackle corruption? Should the specific mechanisms that address corruption not be included in the implementation plan because they will vary with the nature of corruption? And then another question on governance is your on-board appointment. You mentioned that the bill should consider knowledge, skills, experience, honesty, integrity, and expertise in the appointment of board members. I do know that these are mentioned in sections 13, subsections 5B, section 13, subsections 5E, and section 13, subsections 8B. The question is whether this addresses your concerns completely. And you also argue that board members should be independent. That is mentioned in sections 13, subsection 5D, where it says that members of the board cannot be government employees. That means that they should not have a conflict of interest. And then another question that I have for you, and I might take a second round of questions. The question relates to your, again, on the governance issues, because the bulk of your questions and input is based on governance issues. Do you agree with the need for equitable, meaningful, and fair access to quality healthcare for all persons? You also agree that the Bill or the Act addresses the principle of equitable quality care as outlined in Chapter 1? And do you think or accept that legislation covered by the Consumer Protection Act, you've referred extensively to this, the Health Act, and as well as the Constitution addresses your governance concerns? And secondly, that the detail concerning these would be addressed at the stage where stakeholders engage regarding the development of regulations that will enable the implementation of the bill. Hence, these don't necessarily need to be included in the bill. At this point in time, honorable members, just your view also on the medical schemes, which you've spoken about quite a lot, your view on the future role of the medical schemes, I'd also like to hear from you. And also your health reform perspective and proposals that you have. How is that different from the work that has been performed through the Presidential Health Compact? For now, I would stop there and would probably take a second round of questions. We must just be mindful that I had afforded you more time, so maybe your responses could be a little bit shorter and succinct, and I know there are many questions which were asked, but let us see how we can manage that. Thank you very much. You're very welcome to respond.
Honorable Chair, I just have one thing. By the time you were calling me, my gadget was making me to start, so can I please just ask quickly before I want to check
you. You may do that, Honorable Munyo.
On the exclusion of asylum seekers and the undocumented migrants, you argue that the bill excludes open quote asylum seekers and undocumented migrants. Section 6.42 of the bill provides that the asylum seekers or illegal foreigners are entitled to emergency medical services and services for notifiable condition of the of public health concern, e.g. pandemics, will offering NHI-free comprehensive services to non-legal incidents and asylum seekers, not encourage healthcare motivated migration. What will be the impact of the budget of the NHI in this regard? On the issue of HIV and TB services, you maintain that in the bill, there's no testing and treatment for HIV. The bill indicates services will be comprehensive. The financial implications state that comprehensive HIV and AIDS, TB and COS are accounted for. Is that not an indication that testing and treatment of this disease will be included? If please, you can clarify that, those questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Munia. You may answer these questions on presenters. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. For the sake of time, I will respond to the first question, and I will leave the rest of other questions to Sasha. On the first question, when we mentioned, when we gave the breakdown of people that were consulted, if you remember, I also mentioned that that was done by TEC and also on the side of Richize. Richize was having community accountability meetings in seven provinces, which is KZN, Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and Northwest. So in actual sense, TAC is operating in eight provinces except Northern Cape. So when we did these consultations, we also engaged
communities from Northwest, except Northern Cape, because we don't operate in Northern Cape. Over to you, Sasha.
I'm going to try and respond to the many good questions, and thank you for those questions. So I'll start with Ms. Geller's questions about surely if we say we support universal health coverage, why do we not support the provisions of the NHI bill? I think that's my summary of the question. I think as I tried to make clear in the presentation, we support universal coverage. We are both, Section 27 and the TAC are both health activist organizations. We've been working for the last 20 years collectively to try and improve access to healthcare services in the country. And we absolutely support the move towards universal health coverage. That doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything that's in the bill, because there are some elements of the bill that we think actually go against universal health coverage. And it's for that reason that we've made recommendations for how provisions of the bill can be amended to render them constitutionally compliant and to ensure that the bill is able to do what it seeks to do, which is to improve access to quality healthcare services. So I hope that members don't confuse our concern with elements of the bill for an approach that says we want the system to remain as it is. And that was, I think, the gist of another of Ms. Geller's questions, which was that at the moment, our health system is so inequitable. And if there are problems with the fund, are we saying that we just want the health system to remain as it is? And that's absolutely not the case. We are working towards health system reform. We're dedicated to health system reform to ensure equitable access to quality healthcare services for all. And we think that the fund needs some changes to make sure that it can do that. It's not to stop it from doing that, it's actually to make it able to realize what it's trying to do. So that is what we are proposing. And I hope that is clear. On the dissolution of the board, Ms. Geller says that the bill already provides for the minister to consult with the board in relation to dissolution. I've laid out in my presentation, we laid out in our submission, some of the additional measures that we think are required to protect a board from dissolution because it is such a dramatic step. Mere consultation with the board before dissolution, we don't think is sufficient to protect the fund and the board from potential interference through dissolution with the board. And so we've laid out in quite a lot of detail what we think is required. And I'd encourage you to have a look at that. There are a few questions on migrant access to healthcare services, which is not surprising, because it is, of course, a matter of concern that our health system only has so much money. Ms. Geller was concerned that we're advocating for the perpetual existence of undocumented migrants in South Africa, and I don't think that that's quite the right characterization. The health system can't be used as an alternative to a home affairs system, to a board management system. We cannot make our health system punitive and try and use it to squeeze the undocumented migrants out of South Africa. What we need to do is ensure that our health system meets the rights of everyone that's provided for in our constitution. Everyone has the right of access to healthcare services. Everyone has the right not to be refused emergency medical treatment. And that's the case at the moment. And that's a proud tradition in South Africa. And that's what we're proposing remains. It's insufficient for us just to say there's not enough money, we can't treat people who aren't from South Africa, without actually showing how many migrants there are, how migrants being treated impact South Africans. All we have is anecdotes on that. We don't, in fact, have the evidence. And we can't be regressing people's rights of access to healthcare services. There also isn't evidence about health service-based migration in South Africa. As I provided for in the presentation, the provision of emergency medical services and services for notifiable conditions of public health concern to undocumented people is insufficient, particularly because of how poorly that's formulated. And HIV is not, and testing a treatment for people who are not covered under the bill, so asylum seekers and undocumented migrants, is not provided for in the bill, and that's important for the reasons that I gave. Then moving on to Ms. Wilson's question. There was also a question about the future role of medical schemes under the NHI. Section 33 of the bill, which seeks to do away with medical schemes at some unspecified point in the future, I think is concerning for its lack of clarity. I think everyone recognizes that NHI implementation will be a process, and that the intention at the end of the day is to have a single purchaser of almost all healthcare services, with medical aids providing complementary cover. I think that's fine, but what we're talking about now is legislation and what should be included in the legislation. And so to word a provision in such unclear terms is problematic and unnecessarily adversarial. The purpose of NHI, of course, is to pool the funding so that more people can access quality healthcare services and can benefit from the resources that exist in both the public and the private sector. And I think we need to focus on that element first, on how we're going to pool that money, how we're going to govern the structure that holds the money, and how we're going to contract services. That's closer to the certainty for now. Ms. Wilson asked a question about whether we don't already have NHI. I think, no, we don't. We have a public health system that provides healthcare services to those who need it. But the inequity across the system is so dramatic. And everyone knows the numbers. They don't need to be repeated. But we have a lot of money and a lot of excess capacity within the private health sector. And it does make sense to use some of that excess capacity to serve people who use the public health sector. There was a question by Mr. Sakata, and an example of how there has been collaboration between the public and the private health sectors under COVID, and that's certainly to be welcomed, and was something that many of us were worried about at the beginning, given the lack of trust. We do need to build on that. We must note, however, that while there were contracts negotiated for use of private hospital beds by public sector patients during COVID, the only contract, as far as I'm aware, that was actually finalized was in the Western Cape, and it was single digits of patients who were transferred across. So we've seen a lot of good collaboration, but we really need to extend that and see how it can work across the health system and in a time of not being in crisis. So I think there is a need for real health systems change rather than just the refinement of the public health system. There was a question by Mr. Sakata about essentially whether we think that universal health coverage and the provision of services to people on the basis of need is desirable, and I hoped that I'd made that clear in our joint submission from Section 27 and the TAC. That's our reason for being. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And we think that by making the changes that we've proposed, NHI stands a better chance of doing just that, that the health systems reforms that are needed can actually take place, and that funding of health services can be more equitable. So we absolutely agree with universal health coverage. The question is how we get there and how we ensure that the financing system that we're putting in place enables universal health coverage to be implemented. There are a lot of questions, so I'm just trying to make sure I get to them all. Ms. Harvard asked about whether Parliament shouldn't be the democratic body that makes decisions in relation to the way health system reform happens, and why we would need a further consensus-seeking process to resolve some of the matters. And I tried to deal with that at the beginning of my presentation, talking about the global research on how health systems change, sustainable and real health systems change actually happens. And that's not just through legislation. It requires the input and the feedback and the buy-in of people within the system. And that's why we think that a fiat from above is unlikely to get the kind of change that we all know we need. So that's not to say let's stop and wait and talk for another decade. It's to say there are some issues that we need to implement now, and there are some projects or interventions that we need to implement now, and there are some things that do require more consensus building, and we think that should be happening. And linked to that, Mr. Jacobs asked about whether the Presidential Health Compact, in fact, went through that process. And I think anyone who participated in the Presidential Health Compact will recognize that while there were some good elements of that process, it really did not amount to a consensus-seeking process, and that it didn't bring parties really closer together. And so we've made some recommendations in this report that you'll be able to see that we hope that will bring parties closer together. Ms. Harvard also asked about whether board members need to be supported by their institutions. The point that we were making there was just that the board members are not appointed as representatives of their institutions. And so while they may come from institutions, they're not intended to be representatives. And that's the reason why we don't think that they should be removed if they leave that institution. Then Mr. Munyai asked about appointments to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, given their role. There's a list of individuals or kind of representation that should be appointed to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, which we think is fine. It's important, as I made clear, that civil society and health service users are incorporated within both the Stakeholder Advisory Committee and the other advisory committees of the fund. We can't just have health service users in one structure not actually being able to make input and give feedback to the Benefits Advisory Committee and the Pricing Committee. And so we made proposals for that I hope were clear. And then Mr. Jacobs asked about the SIU's Health Sector Anti-Corruption Forum that you're right, we are members of. It's a really important structure, and it's a structure that I think shows the benefit of different parties coming together. The structure has people from law enforcement, people from civil society, people from the private and the public health sectors, and it's a way of transparently dealing with some of the big problems, big corruption problems in health. It's really important for that reason and has to continue. The point that I didn't make clearly enough is that dealing with corruption after the fact is obviously insufficient. And what we need to do is put in place structures that make it more difficult for corruption to happen. And that's the reason why we focus so heavily on governance structures and on setting up those systems so that corruption and maladministration and wastage of funds is more difficult. There's also a need for other corruption provisions in the bill, which we've dealt with in our recent submission. But the point is that we can't always look after the fact. We need to look after the fact, but we also need to do what we can to prevent corruption within the system. And developing a resilient governance mechanism is a way of doing that. And then in relation to appointment, that the principles and qualities for board members. Mr. Jacobs, you're right that there is provision for board members themselves to be act with integrity and honesty, etc. We were also talking about the ad hoc committee that appoints the board members and the importance of specific qualities in those people. And I see that Mr. Jacobs is just entering, so I hope that he heard that. And then in relation to independence, yes, board members mustn't be government employees. We also just need to state that the board itself is independent. That was the point that I was making, not just in relation to its members. And then finally, Mr. Jacobs talked about whether the regulations for implementation wouldn't be the place for some of these issues to be raised, some of the concerns that we've raised. And I think firstly, it's important when we are passing legislation that the matters that are dealt with in legislation are certain, and that we set up the processes and the structures in a way that is protective of the fund and of the decisions that, and of the health system in general. fixing things through regulation doesn't make sense. What we need to do is we need to start a system that is going to improve access to healthcare services in ways that we know we want to implement, and then we can test and improve through regulation. But having participation in a regulation making process and being able to tweak things through regulation isn't the best lawmaking process. And so that's why we think we need to get the basics right now. We need to get the fundamentals right. We need to include in the NHI bill only things that we can start implementing, and then then the minister can use the regulation to the regulation making power to tweak and change implementation as the implementation of NHI unfolds. Mr. Jacobs, I hope that I've answered all of those questions.
Yes, thank you very much. I will hear from the other members whether you had. But before I do that, I see the hand of Honourable Dr. Temukwayo has been up for a little while, raised. Maybe that's a legacy hand, Dr. Temukwayo. We have something new. Honourable Dr. Temukwayo. If not, honourable members, do you have any other questions you'd like to raise now, or any questions which were not answered of yours? You may just mention that, shout your name on this platform, and then ask your question.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's Honourable Wilson.
You're welcome.
I raised concerns over the current situation, and we've talked about the inequity of health, but particularly with regards to the tremendous amount of money that we are using at the moment for medical claims and medical claims that are still to come, as well as legal fees, and how the THC thought that, you know, we have to, how do we circumvent that because that money is going to result in shortages of staff, medical equipment, medical resources. And this is a situation that is going to prevail for quite a long time. And when we know there are thousands of cases on the table still awaiting investigation. So any suggestions in that regard? Thank you.
Any other members? You are welcome to answer the question. And yes, I did hear what you were saying. I'm just switching between gadgets. Hopefully, our power has been restored. And so I was not listening to you. So, yes, you're welcome to respond, Ms. Stevenson.
Thank you. Sorry about that, Ms. Wilson. I forgot the second part of your question. You're right. Medical legal claims are eating up a huge part of the health budget and are a real risk for ongoing provision of quality healthcare services and the improvement in access to quality healthcare services. I know that there are some recommendations on the table at the moment from the South African Law Reform Commission, and different provinces are testing out different ways of managing medical legal claims. They obviously come from different places. You know, there's part of the problem is that there is understaffing in many of our facilities and over our healthcare workers are often run off their feet, and it's really difficult for them to provide the kind of service that we would want them to. Another part of the problem is medical record keeping, and that often there isn't the kind of information on file that's required to defend claims. And then, of course, that there are predatory lawyers who only make the matter worse. But the end result is that we do have these huge medical legal claims, which puts our whole health system at risk. Now, I don't think that the fact that we have medical legal claims means that we shouldn't be implementing health systems reform, and I don't think that was what you were suggesting. But it is something that we need to be dealt with at the same time, just as wastage with and poor service within the public health sector needs to be dealt with, just as under-regulation or dysfunctional regulation of the private health sector, which means that we don't know what services people are actually providing. We don't know what the health outcomes are within the private sector. We don't know what the quality is like across public or private sector. All of these are matters that are urgent that need to be responded to now if we are to improve the health system in the interest of everyone in the country, which I think is a priority for us and obviously also a priority for this committee.
Thank you very much once again for your presentation and for answering the questions of the honourable members. We are very pleased that you have given your presentation. We also know that you have spoken much on the bill, but also around other issues, for example, health systems issues, etc. We appreciate your input. I'm going to allow you to leave the platform should you so wish to do so. You're very welcome to say maybe a last word, and then we will take the next presenter group presenting to us after yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much to this committee for allowing us to make submissions. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairperson, for allowing us this opportunity with the hope that the submission that we have made will receive the necessary attention it deserves, and our recommendations will be attended to. Thank you.
Thank you. Go well. Honourable members, let me just ask Ms. Majalamba. Ms. Majalamba, could you indicate whether the next team is here? Team of the Women's Legal Centre and Sexual Reproductive Justice Coalition.
Yes, Chair, they are on the platform.
Thank you very much. Just a reminder, honourable members, after this presentation, we will also continue to with consideration adoption of minutes. Just allow yourself some time, and also to inform the presenters, coming presenters, that they have 45 minutes, and we will then take another 45 minutes for answers and questions and answers. The previous group had longer because they were two groups in one. Can you indicate who will be leading this delegation and also then introduce your other members to us? Who is leading the delegation of the Women's Legal Centre and Sexual Reproductive Justice Commission?
Apologies, Chair. I was speaking and my mic was still off. I am Shiham Samai. I'm the director of the Women's Legal Centre, and I'm supported here by my attorney, who is Mandi Mudarikwa. But if there's any questions, I will also be prepared. I forwarded our presentation to Viswa. And I don't know if she's going to screen it. If it's a problem, I can also screen it.
Ms. Majalamba, you will be able to answer that. Welcome, Ms. Samai. I know you are military trained, so I'm surprised you need an attorney with you, but I guess you will pick up the team. But you're very welcome to do your presentations to us. I'm just going to sort out who would be writing your presentation. Are you able to do that yourself if you've given co-hosting rights? I think that would be much easier.
Yes. It's still disabled, Chair.
Ms. Majalamba, could you give that to Ms. Samai? Yes, you're now a co-host. If you can also introduce your team. I've heard you mention today, but I think there are more than one of you on the platform. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chief. I'm just trying to... Apologies, Chair. I'm sharing it, and I hope that everybody will be able to see it.
No problem. You can see something, so let's see if how it works.
Okay. Thank you. My problem is that I can't see it, but it's fine. I'll open up another one from my side. Sorry for that. Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chair, these submissions are being made on behalf of the Women's Legal Centre, which is a feminist legal, African feminist legal centre, which advances the rights of women through strategic litigation and advocacy. We aim to develop feminist jurisprudence that recognises and develop and advances the rights of women. All of these submissions have been made in our submissions. Also, the Legal Resource Centre is not here, but the LRC is a public interest legal centre, and they were started in 1979, and it also uses the law as an instrument of justice to facilitate the ability of vulnerable and marginalised persons and communities to assert and develop their rights. So broadly, they have offices all in South Africa. And then finally, both LRC as well as the WLC are members of the Sexual and Reproductive Justice Coalition, which is a South African coalition working towards an intersectional lens on reproductive justice. And the SRJC aims to provide a platform through which individuals and organizations produce and use evidence to foster informed public debate and consensus. Through its work, the SRJC hopes for a future of sexual and reproductive justice informed by an intersectional perspective in which all people, irrespective of class and race, gender and sexual orientation, religion, or any factor, can enjoy their sexuality, make reproductive decisions, and access high-quality services. Thank you, Chair. My colleagues are all here. Mandy Mudarikwa, she's an attorney also at the Women's Legal Centre, but I will be presenting. Inequality in access to healthcare services. Chair, I've got a problem because I can't see my own screen.
If you prefer to send to have Mandy or Mandy, like for you, you're welcome if you are able then to see it better. Let's see what's best for you. We can see your screen.
Okay, do you see the screen? Is it yes. Moving here? Okay.
Yes, it's moving.
Okay. Inequality in access to health care, including sexual reproductive health. Chair, the right to health care is enshrined in the Constitution. It includes the right to reproductive health care. And the bill seeks to ensure that the entire population is entitled to benefit from necessary high qualitative health care services. The legacy of apartheid saw that the healthcare system remains split along racial lines. The healthcare system continues to benefit the white minority population, whilst remaining severely under-resourced and inaccessible to the black majority. It continues to perpetuate the systemic inequalities designed and implemented by racist regime. It is common cause that majority of South Africans from low income and poor households rely on the public healthcare system. Approximately 83% of the population, and women experience higher levels of poverty than their male counterparts, and we have the percentages. In using distance to the nearest hospital, just as an example and an indicator, a recent joint study by the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation and the World Bank showed that the poorest in South Africa lived at least 20 kilometers away from a hospital, which was 27 percentage points higher than the proportion of the richest decile. Even more, rural communities is consistently higher among persons living in these areas. Race and gender, Chair, Within this inequality in access to resources along poverty lines is a racial and gender divide. Black women in South Africa is in the worst position when accessing healthcare services, and the quality of these services are severely stunted, with only 5 out of 649 public healthcare facilities across South Africa actually complying with the norms and the standards set up by the department. It follows that the experience of access to sexual health and reproductive rights tracks the same disproportionate pattern of unequal distribution. So the public health care system is in such a skewed state. These services are used by the majority of the population, women, and it is imperative for the legislature to ensure that women are no longer neglected when formulating these laws and policies. We submit that the NHI within an ineffective and unequal system will fail. This is because, as a result, it is necessary to improve the system prior to enacting the NHI bill and seeking to implement it. The challenges of inequality are exacerbated by the existing weak healthcare system, and the NHI bill cannot function in an unsustainable system. Furthermore, those sections that speak to the objective of strengthening the healthcare system and putting in measures in place are inadequate in ensuring follow-through, a great deal of responsibility at the discretion of the Minister of Health. It is submitted that in its current formulation, this plan of action or avenue of redress is weak in setting out clear parameters within which the fund will work within and alongside the current provincial departments of health to ensure the proper improvement of public healthcare system, even more to do so adequately would require concerted efforts on the part of the state to the exclusion of the implementation of the NHI. Given the dire state of the public healthcare system, consequently, we submit that the NHI cannot proceed as it will not succeed in the current public healthcare system. Quality sexual and reproductive healthcare services, there's a divide in terms of the public and private. And according to a report that was done by Amnesty International, it was found that the private healthcare sector employs the majority of healthcare professionals and spends nearly 6 times more per patient in comparison to the public healthcare system. The disproportionate access in care and services applies to the provisions of sexual and reproductive healthcare services to women who rely on the public system. As stated before, this divide in access intersects across gender, race, economic lines. Should the NHI be passed, we submit that there is a high probability that more of the services will be procured from the private healthcare services sector versus from the public healthcare sector, given the disparities in quality and access to care. It is likely that this will occur alongside the strengthening of the public healthcare system as proposed by the NHI. However, we submit that this will create an over-reliance on access to private healthcare providers and establishments set at a higher rate than those in public sector, but which resources, both human and medical, will not be able to sustain servicing the 83% of the South African population who historically relied on the public healthcare system. Consequently, the current operation of the system in South Africa along public and private lines and the weak state of public healthcare system cannot support the effective implementation of the NHI. It is necessary to first close the gaps in access and service provision that exist between the private and public. The effect of the unequal access to women's access to comprehensive and quality services with respect to the women's experience of healthcare and services during childbirth, these services continue to be divided on racial lines. Black and colored women give birth primarily in public facilities and white women in private. The experience of women in the public health facilities indicates poor, unequal and inefficient medical care, which even often give rise to medical negligence. Women accessing maternal health care services at public of our facilities attested to the negative interpersonal care given by caregivers. Abortion services provision in the public healthcare sector is riddled with obstacles for women trying to access these services. The stigma and discrimination continue. This is often expressed through health facilities and providers refusing services on the ground of religious belief and conscience, turning women away when they seek an abortion and often without referring them to a healthcare provider who is willing to assist them. Restricted access to doctors authorized to provide terminations. There's also a limited number of healthcare facilities at which women can access abortion services. Of the 505 facilities designed to offer abortion services, only 264 are providing access. Poorly trained or untrained staff employed at these limited healthcare facilities are unable to provide women access to abortion. It's estimated that 50% of abortions are procured in the informal sector. Our conclusion is that substantive equality continues to be aspirational that many women of color have not enjoyed at all, especially in accessing health, including sexual and reproductive rights. It is therefore imperative for the legislature to ensure that women are no longer neglected and ignored when formulating laws and policies on health in this instance. We refer you also further to our submissions for more details on this presentation. Thank you, Chair. If there's any questions from the various participants, we can continue.
You're welcome to continue. Do you have a further presentation or are you complete?
We are complete, Chair. We just thought that in terms of time and our submissions are obviously much more substantive, but we just brought out the important inputs.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you have had the presentation now. I'm trying to look at my platform to see who will be asking any questions. You are also welcome to just talk here for me. Give me a moment, and we did not expect the first person member to ask this question is Honorable Sukacha. Honorable Sukacha's first. Any other members? I'm looking at the platform.
Chairperson, can you please note me?
Thank you, Honorable Gayla. Anyone else?
Robert.
Anyone else?
I'm covered, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much again for that presentation. We have a couple of members who want to.
And me, Chairperson.
And Munyai, we have a couple of members who want to raise some questions with you. So I'm going to name them. It's Honorable Sukacha, Gela, Harvard, Munyai, in that order. Thank you very much. Please go ahead, Honorable Members. Honorable Sukacha.
Chairperson, while Honorable Sukacha is still struggling, can you please allow me to ask my question? Of course, with your permission, Chair.
You're welcome. So it would be Honorable Gela, Harvard, Munyai, Sukacha. Thank you. Continue, Honorable Gela.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first welcome the presentation. I've got one question that I want to ask to the presenter. My question, Chair, in their submission, you state that the NHI bill should not proceed unless the health system improves. It is a common knowledge that the British implemented the national health system at the worst time when the system was failing. It is reported that there was a patchwork of different services that all had varying level of quality and access. Today, the British NHS is a model system for comprehensive quality healthcare for all. Should South Africa not follow this proven model of healthcare? Thank you, Chair. Lastly, my second question. Thank you for your presentation. Just to clarify, I do not recall nothing in the book that access for women should be discriminated. Can you identify the section in the bill that alludes to this? And can you also suggest the wording that will address your concern? Thank you, Chair.
Can I?
Thank you very much.
Chair, I was about to ask questions. There the bus comes. I must run to the bus now. I was going to ask just one question, Chair. There's the bus, Chair. Can I ask later? Sorry.
You can post to me. Thank you. I will ask it for you.
Yeah. Okay, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Abbott?
Yes, Chair. Only one question. In your submission, you indicated that NHI is formulated with a 1 week and unequal system and by induction. You also state there is no cooperation with provincial departments, ministry, statutory bodies, and parliament. Can you provide evidence of this lack of cooperation in the public healthcare system? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I want to ask the following question. In your submission, you really indicated the following. You indicated that NHI formulated, let me just rephrase the question. In your submission, you indicate that NHI is formulated within a week and an equal system, and by indication, you also state that there is no cooperation within provincial departments, ministry, statutory bodies, and parliament. Can you provide evidence of the lack of this cooperation in the public health care system? Because that is very important. But also, in your presentation, maybe I must thank you for your presentation. Can you please just clarify the following, because I do not recall noting in the bill that access of women should be discriminated. I never saw that, but it's important if you can indicate where in the bill such a thing exists, because if you can identify, can you please identify the section in the bill such that alludes to this, and can you also suggest the wording that will address your concern? If please you can clarify, where do you find such in the bill that this access for women should be discriminated? Because we should not raise issues, Honorable Chair, which are not within the bill itself, and make it as if they're in the bill, because that will be subjective of reality rather than objective reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I don't think there are any other members which would want to raise any questions on this platform. Just for me to maybe ask a few, Mr. Mai and your team.
You indicated
that the motion expressed a provision for the procurement of adequate and comprehensive sexual and reproductive health care and services for women. And you're simply referring to the
Section 1.
Yes.
In HR Bill. And so,
yes,
Chair, maybe...
Can I continue to finish my questions?
Yes, yes.
Thank you. Now, particularly the most vulnerable and the under-resourced, and you're aware that in Section 27, Subsection 1A of the Constitution, everyone has the right to have access to healthcare services, I'm sure you know, including reproductive health. Does that definition not include the healthcare services which you talk about, which include reproductive healthcare and emergency medical treatment? And then in Section 39, Subsection 8A states that if an accredited provider fails to provide comprehensive health services to people entitled to receive the services, the NHI fund may withdraw or refuse to accredit the provider further. I understand that this is an indication that the bill intends to ensure comprehensive services are provided, and what would be your view on that? And then in your presentation, you also suggest that before the NHI is implemented, the government must close the gap between public and private sectors in terms of quality. And how is that expected to occur with the current funding arrangement where the state subsidizes the private sector through medical aids? And is NHI not a means to close the gap between the public and private sectors by providing quality, universal health coverage to all based on need and not income? And yes, those are the questions which have been raised by the honorable members to you. You're very welcome to answer all of those questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague,
Chair.
Yes, honorable Kayla.
I just want to check, have you raised the question of honorable Police Sokaj?
Yes, I have.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, I think maybe in terms of our slides, but I'm going to refer now to our submissions. Remember that the presentation that we've made is only highlights that came out of our actual submissions, and I'm assuming that the different members have actually read it. So I'm just going to go through some of the provisions, and I think it's important to note that there was a bit of a misunderstanding around us saying that women are being discriminated. We are saying that the bill exists in a broad framework, which is also discriminatory in nature, and I will be able to explain to you. I hope some of the questions have been similar. I think that in terms of our submissions, and I'm going to read it now, the specific submissions in respect of the bill. It's submitted that should the bill continue along the legislative process, that certain amendments are made to ensure that women's access to comprehensive and quality sexual and reproductive health services be a priority within the structure of the NHI. It is necessary to embed this in the ethos, in the language of the bill, ensuring a committed legislative dedication to improving women's access. More particularly, we are saying in terms of Section 1, when it comes to the definitions, comprehensive healthcare services in its current iteration, though it refers to a range of objectives, the services are to ensure. The definition does not provide a list of necessary services to be provided that would serve as a basic makeup of this care services.
We submit that this section requires a more robust definition to ensure the public is aware of those services to which they would be entitled and to which the fund would strive to attain when procuring services on behalf of the public. We further submit that the definition includes, like the difference, that it should include the following, and we make submissions on that, on what those services should be, which includes a range of services around information, access to a wide range of contraceptives, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to that, Chair, the definition of healthcare services includes reproductive healthcare, the meaning of which must correspond with the expanded definition provided above. It would be necessary to insert a reference to the definition, and this ensures that where either term is used throughout the Act, that it includes an express mention of the healthcare services, and that those services and benefits be procured will always include those listed in the definition. In relation to those discriminatory practices, we are submitting that the lack of cooperation arises from how some of the provinces have some SRHR, while some have barely any services without much attempts to ensure that those in the neglected or poor serviced areas are being assisted. I will give you an example in relation to abortion services. We had to do a comprehensive access to information application, which is not necessary in relation to services that have that is available, abortion services that is available in terms of the Act, and to ensure that it gets disseminated to those that require it. And I've indicated what the stats were in terms of the number of abortion services that is actually compliant with the norms and standards is less than half than what is there. And we at the Women's Legal Center made a comprehensive application. And I can say that we have less than three applications and information that we have received in relation to those particular services. And that is but one example. My colleague is here, which is Mandy Mederikwa, and I think it's very important that she speaks to the issue of the forced sterilization that is happening within in the system of HIV positive women, notwithstanding some of the provisions and also policies that have been set out in relation to sterilization and consent. I think there's a lot of work, and we are currently in the court system around most of these provisions because of the broad failure of the state in relation to women and their sexual health and reproductive rights. With regard to the budgets, et cetera, I do understand it's not that we are saying that the NHI is not necessary and it's not needed in terms of ensuring that the gap, the inequality gap is reduced. However, we are saying building an NHI on an existing fraud and equal system might cause more issues within that particular system. And in addition to that, if then it is to proceed, we are saying that those things need to be highlighted and those definitions need to be expanded. Because if we are speaking about substantive equality and not just formal equality, which is just the law that being there, we are saying on the level of substantive equality in accessing SRHRs, there will be discrimination. And we want this committee to be able to lend the NHI through a feminist gendered lens so that we will be able to catch and ensure that those that are the most vulnerable are not falling through the cracks. I have to admit, the Women's Legal Center is a law firm when it comes to budgets and the economy. I have to say that for us at the end of the day, yes, the NHI is to be able to bridge that gap, but we are also saying that where those services are lying, it's sitting in the private sector, and it is not going to benefit any one of us if those services is going to be procured for almost 83% of the country. Thank you, and we just we would want this bill to be assessed from the gendered economic perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair, I have to, I profusely apologize, and I hope if there's maybe more questions, we'll be able to answer. But I have a flight back to Cape Town, and yeah.
Thank you very much. We're about to wrap up. We appreciate your coming to do your presentation to us. We're noting what your concern, and yes, enjoy your flight back home.
Thank you.
Any other last words?
No, Chair. I don't think there's anything from my colleague Mandy, but those are submissions. Thank you.
All right. You're very welcome to leave. Thank you very much. We are staying behind because we do have some other work to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Honourable members, we are now going to look at some minutes. We are very fortunate in the sense that our team, our staffing team, is really attending to this very quickly. And so we are able to stay up to date with the minutes as we are going now, also considering that we are coming towards the end of this year, and we wouldn't want anything to stand over necessarily for next year. Ms. Majalamba, would you be able to announce those minutes and slide them for us, please?
It's the 19th of December and the, sorry, Chair, 19th of November and the 24th of November. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, your birthday. So we are very close to being able to manage our minutes. There are the minutes now. Please make note that the 19th of November, note whether you are present, note that you've been present, or whether you have tendered an apology. You may scroll, Ms. Majalamba. And this, in this particular minute, it was a briefing that we were receiving from the Minister of Health. These were forwarded to you. We would think you would have read it. And this had to do with our preparation of the committee's reports for the BRRR process. We're now on page 3. Anything that you noted that you would want to change or add or which has been omitted? We're now on page 4.
So can we just go back a little bit there where it stands of opposition parties? Yeah, just pause that, please. Thanks.
Please do, Ms. Majalamba. Just say where, Mr. Honorable Tara.
No, it's fine now. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you.
Oh, I was muted. Can I please ask for somebody to move for the adoption of the minutes?
I will move, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sardin. Any seconder?
I second it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dr. Harvard, so these minutes have been duly adopted, honourable members. The next set of minutes, Ms. Majalamba.
Minutes of the 24th of November, Chair, when we are
doing
our report.
Please note whether you have been captured correctly to be present, honourable members. Scroll, Ms. Majalamba. And this was specifically for us to consider and adopt the committee's BRRR. You may scroll. Very short. There are the resolutions. The workshop should be convened between the committee and the minister. And this is the committee of the Standing Provincial Performance Report. And the committee agrees on the NHI public hearing. Anybody to approve or to move for the adoption of the minutes?
Sorry, Chair, can we go up one page?
Yes.
Whoa, it's too far now. Okay, well, thank you.
Anything you want to add, honourable members? Are you happy with it?
I'm happy, Chair.
Yes, Chair, I'm happy. Chair, I move for the approval of the minutes.
Thank you very much, Honourable Gela. Any seconder?
I'll second, Chair.
Second.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I just want to bring to your attention that we had sent out an email which speaks to outstanding matters. I hope you would have received it. We're not going to discuss those now. But if you had not looked at your emails, please have a look at it, because we will be having another meeting next week. And we have, with Ms. Bajalamba and I, are trying to note all of the outstanding matters, and you should be applying your minds in case we had missed anything in particular. And then please do not forget that we're having the briefing tonight by the minister and the department. I think the minister is on a provincial visit. And we'll have the deputy minister and the department coming to present to us on the latest on the Omicron variant and the health outcomes expected due to this variant. That brings us to the end of our meeting. Thank you very much for attending.
Sorry, Chairperson, please can you confirm the meeting's at 6:30 with the Minister, am I correct?
Yes, it is. Mr. Bajalamba, can you just verify with me?
Yes, Chair, the meeting is at 6:30. I will send the link for that meeting after this meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And don't forget, we have plenary at 3 o'clock and immediately after that plenary. That's why we're hoping for 18:30 for that meeting to take place. Thank you very much, honourable members. Have a good day.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.